Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Don. I'm Dr. Don Motika, your host for an hour of medical news, information, debate, dialogue, discussion, answers to your questions on the air and via email at AskDrDon.com. Well, welcome, and before we go any further, as usual, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Well, just a moment ago, Alan alluded to the quote-unquote famous Dr. Don hangover cure, which actually isn't a cure, it's more of a preventative measure. And I have to credit this. I learned this from my English boyfriend back in college. And of course, coming from a long culture of people who quaff potentially to holiday excess, he had some clues about how to prevent them. And his big solution was electrolytes. And I've had the opportunity from time to time to check this myself. And indeed, it works out pretty well. So ironically enough, the best hangover cure is before you fall asleep to drink about 8 to 16 ounces of Pedialyte or Rice-A-Lite or one of these other infant oral rehydration formulas. The rehydration is essentially sodium and glucose and a little bit of potassium. And these are the things that get messed up overnight when you've had too much to drink. Your body has to deal with some of the compounds, and certainly those who are heavy drinkers or have had the occasion to be in their life will tell you that the more interestingly flavored the concoction, the more likely it is to cause a hangover. And that's simply because there's more for the liver to deal with in detoxifying it overnight. And you've set up a situation where your antidiuretic hormone is suppressed. That's one of the effects of alcohol. One of the reasons why you don't buy beer, you only borrow it. So you lose water into the bladder and at the same time deplete your system of electrolytes at the same time that you're putting a high demand on the liver to detoxify. Sort of a bad recipe. So the solution, hydrate, hydrate, hydrate. Hydrate ahead of time if you can, the night before. But at least if you wake up in the middle of the night, do that 16 ounces of fluid. And because alcohol is a potent disruptor of the sleep cycle, you probably will wake up. Well, you know, one of the fun things about turning 50 is you get your first letter from the American Association of Retired Persons asking you if you'd like to join. And you also get on the mailing list for the Lifeline screening people, who also had a little pink flyer in my local newspaper this week. And I like the letter better. I mean, the pink flyer says, "We can help you avoid a stroke." And then it talks about carotid artery screening and abdominal aortic aneurysm screening and peripheral artery disease screening, and tells you, you know, all sorts of scary statistics. 12 million people suffer from peripheral artery disease. Yes, and you know who you are because your feet are cold and your legs cramp. Peripheral artery disease is not something that you're not going to know you have. And if you get a physical every year, which hopefully you do, your doctor is checking the pulses in your ankles and feet. And if you've got a good strong pulse in your ankles and feet, you don't have peripheral artery disease. I really don't need an ultrasound to tell me that. Abdominal aneurysm screening. Now, this is one that you could arguably say we should be doing more of medically. And who should get one? Well, anybody with a family history of abdominal or aortic aneurysm, men over 50 who have ever smoked, and women over 60 who have ever smoked. Those are the people who are at high enough risk to make it worthwhile for screening. The majority of people with aortic aneurysms have no symptoms. That's absolutely true. And in the letter that I got from the lovely Lifeline screening people, they tell me about, you know, there's all these little testimonials. D&T Uphouse in Concord, California. Thanks to Lifeline screening, Thomas is being followed regularly by his cardiovascular surgeon after testing found a 3-centimeter aneurysm. Well, you know what we do with the 3-centimeter aneurysm, D&T Uphouse? Absolutely nothing. We do what we normally do, control blood pressure, get the cholesterol down, and that's it. We don't even think about doing anything with an aneurysm until it's 5 centimeters, because under that, they just don't rupture. It's not an issue. On the other hand, D&T Uphouse, T, I presume T is the guy with the aneurysm, Thomas, yes, is now medically uninsurable, hope he's Medicare age, and can't get life insurance because he has this medical condition, he is now a person with a disease, and he's now a very poor risk. Although realistically, from an actual actuarial standpoint, he's not at that much risk. And he probably shouldn't have found out he has the aneurysm, because there's really no meaningful change in his life, except now when he runs or has sex or does sit-ups or gets belly pain, he has anxiety, which he wouldn't have had if he didn't know he had this silent 3-centimeter aneurysm. There are a lot of things. I'm not going to tell you about all of them, but there's a lot of things we don't screen for because we can't do anything about them except scare you if you have them. Now, the last one here, carotid artery stroke screening, atherosclerosis in the carotid artery, another PW disease issue, really, for the most part. If you have blockage in your carotid artery, the real question I have medically is whether or not you're getting adequate blood flow to the brain. And I might want to do a look at your vertebral arteries to see whether the arteries in the back of the neck are supplying enough, given that one of the carotids is taken out. Realistically, if you've got one open carotid and one closed carotid, you're probably fine. If you've got two blocked up carotids that are under 50% blocked, we're not going to do anything about it. If you've got a carotid that's 70 to 80% blocked and have no symptoms, we're not going to do anything about it. You know why? Because the risk of giving you a stroke in trying to treat your silent carotid disease is significant. You get to pay for this. You get to pay $139 for your wellness package, which includes free osteoporosis screening, which isn't worth anything anyway because you're screening the foot with ultrasound, which we know has poor correlation with hip and spine fractures. If you want to know if you've got osteoporosis, get a dual electron X-ray absorptiometry. That is to say, a DEXA scan. That's what you need for osteoporosis. And it is covered by most insurances. And when you're postmenopausal, and men usually can get it through their insurance if they have any risk factor, one of which, by the way, is long-term moderate to heavy alcohol consumption. So should we be doing this screening? Not really, but boy, do they make a good effort and a very effective marketing ploy in selling this. I'm sure they make a lot of money, but I really don't recommend that you go and get the screening done. And in 20 years of looking at these ads, I've actually never had anyone come in with anything that needed to be addressed or that should have been addressed or that caught anything early. So I'm sure there's people out there with their 3-centimeter aneurysms who are happy to know that. But personally, my advice is, don't open the box unless you have symptoms or meet those criteria I mentioned for abdominal aneurysm. By the way, if you Google carotid artery atherosclerosis, the second item that comes up, obviously a paid position, is lifelinescreening.com. Yeah, those people have made a real business out of creating a need and then meeting that need. This email from last week, we didn't get to. Catherine in Santa Cruz writes, I recently had a bone density test with some results falling into the osteoporosis category. She gives some T-scores of minus 2.6 and 2.5. She's 58-year-old, had menopause within the last 2 years, and has a history of hyperparathyroidism, which was treated surgically 4 years ago. Could you give some guidelines for treatment of the osteoporosis and the various medications? And when are jumping jacks, calcium, and vitamin D alone appropriate? Will it be necessary to take medications for the rest of our lives once we start? Also, any help with understanding the various terms on the report? So, Catherine, let's start with just osteoporosis in general. This is a disease that's really kind of a gray zone. So a person has normal bones, and normal bones, by the way, are kind of defined as what a healthy 30-year-old woman has. A healthy 30-year-old woman who exercises is assumed to have reached the sort of lifetime maximum bones. It peaks late because, you know, you're building all those bones in your teens, but it takes about 10 years to mineralize them. Anyway, the healthy 30-year-old woman falls off a 3-story building, she's going to break her hip. She slips and falls at the ice skating rink, she's not going to break her hip. And so we kind of have a sense for how strong bones typically are in a healthy human. So the T-score is a standard deviation around that normal. So a T-score of 0 is actually the average healthy 30-year-old woman. And for every minus 1, minus 1.5, minus 2.5 in your case, that represents a standard deviation down from that average. When you get to a T-score of minus 2.5, you have an increased statistical risk of fracturing with ordinary activity. And so it's still a statistical risk, and it doesn't mean that you will fracture. You can fall and not break anything with a T-score of minus 2.5. It's just that you have a higher probability, and that probability is roughly about 4 times or 400% of the probability given the amount of trauma of that healthy 30-year-old woman. So at that point, the probability is high enough, the fracture rate starts to be 1 or 2% a year in that population, it starts to be a public health issue. We decide to define it as a disease, but it's really a continuum. And depending on where you are in that continuum, and there are a few other factors to consider as well, one of which is, what's your family history? And number two is, what's your current rate of bone loss? Now, you can get a urine test that looks at bone breakdown products, and it can tell you whether you are still rapidly losing bone. And that's important. The other thing that I want to point out is, because of the hyperparathyroidism, this is a disease where you have elevated levels of parathyroid hormone. It's a little tiny gland on the back of the thyroid, hence the name parathyroid. But parathyroid hormone's job is to take calcium out of bone and use it to buffer the pH of your blood. It's very, very significantly controlled by the rate of calcium absorption, by what the kidneys are doing, and how the buffering system is working. In this disease, where you have high levels of the hormone, you just suck calcium out of the bones. So in a person who's had hyperparathyroidism that is now surgically cured, I am very, very interested in what their ongoing bone balance is. The test to ask for is deoxypyridine and urinary pyridinylene crosslinks. Okay, that's complicated, and I'll put it on the website and also include the local laboratory's codes for that on the website as well, so that you can ask your doctor for that specifically. But if those levels are in the balanced range, then you're probably not progressing rapidly anymore. Now we want to think about building bones up. Certainly, calcium, adequate levels of vitamin D, say 2,000 international units a day, and 1,500 milligrams of the calcium, probably between 800 and 1,500 milligrams of magnesium, no sodas, nothing with phosphoric acid in it. These are all real important things for you to be doing. It might be reasonable to use Forteo, which is an injectable drug that rebuilds bone fairly rapidly. And you could theoretically reverse the effects of your hyperparathyroidism by using Forteo for a brief period of time, say 6 months to a year, and then simply stop everything, keep the weight-bearing exercise going, and monitor those crosslinks, those pyridinylinium crosslinks, to make sure that your bones stay in reasonably good balance. So I hope that's helpful for you. And you can always email me back for further clarification at askdrdawn.com. Right now, we're going to go to some callers. We have Janet in Santa Cruz. Hello, Janet.
Hi, Dr. Dunn.
Hi.
I really appreciate your program.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I've had what I was told were herpes outbreaks from probably about 20 years ago.
Is this oral or genital?
Well, it's not even genital. It's on my buttock.
Okay, that's probably genital, though.
Okay.
In terms of the type 1 versus type 2.
It's always confused me.
Yeah, it's confusing.
Yes.
Go ahead with your question.
Well, anyway, I just would like your recommendations for how to avoid outbreaks, because, for the last 4 years, they've been pretty continuous.
Continuous? Oh, I don't like the sound of that.
Well, you know, it feels continuous because I just get healed from one outbreak, and then, you know, it could be a few weeks later that I have another one. Sometimes they're right one after another.
Just a little metaphor for you. Remember the Sorcerer's Apprentice in Fantasia? Mickey Mouse with the wizard's hat on? Remember,
uh-huh.
Remember that?
Yeah.
And you know how he gets the broom carrying the buckets, and then he can't get it stopped, and so he chops it up, and then suddenly he's got like dozens of brooms carrying buckets, and the whole thing gets out of control. Well, that's what happens with viruses. And effectively, I think you've got a little loop going on here where you're amplifying the virus every time you have an outbreak, and more cells in that nerve are actually becoming affected. So what we really want to do is we want to stop having you make so many copies of the virus and suppress the production of the virus for several years. And the best way to do that is the antiviral drugs. Some people are fortunate enough that they can take lysine, which is an amino acid. If you are don't have high blood pressure and you want to try lysine first, the dose on that is probably 3 to 4 grams. That's 3,000 to 4,000 milligrams a day. So it's a lot of lysine. In some people, that works really well to suppress the virus. In others, it does nothing. And so you try it or not. The drugs I'm talking about are the drugs Zovirax or acyclovir, which is now a generic, and valacyclovir and famciclovir, which are all sound alike, and they sound alike because they have very similar properties. They are chain terminators. So when the virus is building its viral DNA, the drug gets incorporated into the viral DNA, and it doesn't have a hook on the end, so the next link of nucleotide can't hook on, so you end up with a chain termination. So effectively, it's like a birth control pill for the virus. Keeps the virus from reproducing. And if you stop or limit viral replication for multiple cycles, multiple cell cycles in your body, then you end up with a lower chance that you're going to continue to have these outbreaks. The other things that you might expect, you know, keep the stress level low, good nutrition, support the immune system. These are all things that are beneficial as well. But it sounds to me like you've gotten into one of these out-of-control loops, and it's really time to squash the virus for a while.
So I'd always heard that, and this is not a very educated take on it, but I had heard that when you take certain drugs to suppress viruses, that you're actually pushing the virus deeper into the body. It's kind of a homeopathic theory or point of view.
Well, I guess, I've heard all kinds of things, but, you know, it's there. It's already deep in your body. The stuff is already incorporated into your genome, and you're not getting it out, ever.
Right.
I mean, done deal. So if you want to try something homeopathic and see if it works, you know, I'm all for the kinder, gentler treatment, but I don't really worry about Zovirax and the acyclovir drugs because we've done the experiment. I'm sadder, happy to say, and I'm not happy that we've had to do this, but when babies are born with herpes, we give them very, very high doses of this stuff intravenously to newborn babies. We've now had this around for 20 years, so those newborn babies have now grown up and had babies.
Uh-huh.
And there's nothing wrong with them. I mean, there's nothing we can find that shows that they had an adverse experience or an adverse effect. And newborn babies are the most vulnerable stage in our existence. So I think if the drug were really bad for us, if it had some kind of joker in the deck sort of long-term side effect,
right,
we'd have spotted it by now. And that makes me pretty comfortable telling people, look, let's just suppress the virus for a couple of years. And then most of the time you can stop the drug and just, if you start to get a tingle, take a few doses and keep the outbreak from getting rolling again. But I think you need to break the momentum here.
Well, that sounds like really good advice.
Good luck.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great. Bye-bye.
Bye. Just a related story. This comes from Science Daily, a release this month, December 7th, actually. Some researchers looking at the other kind of herpes virus, herpes simplex 1, recently published a rather interesting finding. They discovered that herpes simplex 1 viral DNA is located in the plaques. 90% of plaques in Alzheimer's disease sufferers contain this virus, and most of the viral DNA is in or within the amyloid plaques. So this group has been exploring the possible factor of herpes simplex 1 as a trigger for Alzheimer's disease. It's probably not the only total cause. I mean, we know there's family history aspects to it. We know that the type of beta amyloid you make, what DNA codes for it. We know the ApoE, whether if you have a certain type of ApoE, type 4, you have a much higher risk of Alzheimer's disease. So it's a multifactorial thing. But it does raise the possibility that we get Alzheimer's because of an interaction between our genetics and our environment, and that one of the environmental aspects here is herpes simplex 1. It's a bit creepy when you consider that 80% of the population has herpes simplex. And I want to caution people that there isn't any evidence as yet that using acyclovir for suppression will affect the course of Alzheimer's disease. But that's the obvious direction that the research is going to take now. And stay tuned, and I'll keep you appraised. Let's go to Jim in Felton. Hello, Jim. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I'm calling about my right heel, and I'm not really sure what's up with it, but I had left knee damage when I was a teenager, and I'm in my 50s now. And so I'm also right-legged, and so I rely on my right leg a lot. I'm also a drummer, so I play, I hit the bass drum with my left all the time.
Uh-huh.
So it takes more work. When I'm standing, I stand on my right side, put the weight mostly on my right foot, just by nature over the years now. I noticed over the last year I was wearing these shoes. They're called naturalizers, and they're really comfortable, but they didn't really have much arch support. What's been going on is I've been experiencing this heel pain on my good foot, my right foot, and I noticed the callus has been developing bigger, and I've been working on it. I've considered the possibility of it being a heel spur or just a bone bruise. Sometimes I play on surfaces that are really kind of hard, sort of like you're running or walking on cement or something. It's not that great.
Let me ask you a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
When you get up in the morning and you first stand up,
yeah,
does it hurt a lot then?
Yeah, I'm careful. Right now I'm more careful in the morning, and yes, but it dissipates pretty quickly.
Right, you walk it out, and then if you were to sit down, maybe go to a movie or do a long car ride or something, and you got back out of the car or stood up after the movie a couple hours, will it have gotten a little worse again?
Yeah, it's tender in one spot. It's kind of a tingly sort of a stinging thing. And then I'm putting more weight on my other foot now, and I've been massaging the...
Okay, so let me tell you what...
Yeah, go ahead.
Let me tell you, I think it's probably a plantar fasciitis, which is the support tissue. The fascia is kind of the stuff that holds the flesh together. It's between the muscles and the tendons, and there's a whole line of fascia on the bottom of the foot that helps maintain the arch, and it also connects the toes to the toe flexors, which are... You know, actually, when you squeeze your toes, you use muscles in the bottom of your feet, but you also use muscles in the back of your calf.
Uh-huh.
So basically, as we get older and things get a little stiffer, this particular area tends to develop a little low-grade traction inflammation. And the two best things to do for it are stretching out the Achilles tendon.
Okay.
All right. And also arch support. Now, you mentioned that you have an uneven callus, and so... It's possible that you would benefit particularly from one of these heel pads that have a hole in the center. So it's kind of like a donut pad, and it transfers the weight from the center of the heel to the sides of the heel. Do you have health insurance?
No.
Okay. Because if you did, I would say go to a foot doctor, let a podiatrist take a look at your feet. And when you go, you take a worn out pair of shoes, maybe take those naturalizers, then take some running shoes or some other shoes that you've worn down. Because the shoes are like Sherlock Holmes level clue when they've worn out, because they tell everything about how the foot moves and twists.
I know I pronate.
Yeah, exactly. Since you don't have health insurance, we're not going to go there. I'm just going to have you do some really simple stretching exercises for a couple of weeks and see if you can't benefit just from that and getting a good arch support.
Great.
Okay? So the stretching exercises, before you get out of bed in the morning, take the belt from a bathrobe or a strap, elastic band if you've got one of those exercise bands, put it over the front part of your foot, put it under the sole of the foot, and pull your foot up so that your toes are heading towards your nose.
When you say the front, you're talking about like the ball of my foot?
Ball of your foot underneath, yeah.
Okay.
And then you're just going to stretch, hold that stretch for about 30 seconds, good strong stretch in the back of the calf. Okay, do both sides. Do it a couple of cycles, maybe three cycles. It'll take 5 minutes, maybe a little less. Then get up. And if I'm right, just by doing that, you'll have less pain when you first stand up.
Yeah.
Okay, then you're going to do that when you've been sitting for a while. You do the stretch again. You can actually use your muscles. It's better to use a rope, but you can use your muscles if you don't happen to have a rope handy or a belt handy. And then the other stretch, and this is the one that I just find just totally beats it back really easily, is you stand on a step. And you put the front part, the ball of your foot, right up to the knuckles of your foot on the stair, and you drop your weight, and you let all of your weight push down on the heel so that you really stretch out that calf muscle and that Achilles tendon. And your foot kind of curves and forms a sort of upside-down J curve as much as you can get it to do that.
Wow, that's cool.
And then you just let it stand 15 to 30 seconds, alternate several cycles. And that just really seems to do wonderful things for plantar fasciitis. And it sounds like you've got a relatively mild case. Now, if it's something else, this won't help. And then you can call back next week. Okay?
Thank you, Dr. Dunn.
All right. Take care. Have a good day. Bye-bye. We had an off-air comment related to the plantar fasciitis color, or what I thought might be plantar fasciitis. Comment, I was too lazy to do the exercises for plantar fasciitis, but I do yoga, and the downward-facing dog stretches in the calf cured me. And I'm thinking about that pose, the downward dog, it's sort of an inverted V, and yep, that would definitely be putting that Achilles tendon on plenty of stretch, and so doesn't surprise me that that worked as an alternative. Let's go now to Tony in Live Oak. Hello, Tony. Welcome to the program.
Just by coincidence, I'm a first-time listener, and I have a friend who's probably got osteoporosis problems.
Yes?
Because I read this Discovery Magazine article a few years ago, it was the August issue, 3 or 4 years ago, about how milk actually takes out more calcium out of your bones than it puts in. And that's because of the processing of the milk protein.
Right, because the protein is acidic and you have to buffer it with the calcium. Right, exactly.
So a lot of people don't realize that. And I had a friend of mine, 88 years old, who I believe committed suicide by milk. He's a famous man who was just getting a little senile, and he was convinced that milk was the only thing that could cure his problems. And it turned out that all of the bones in his feet broke up, and he got problems with that, and he just lay down and died because he was in so much pain.
Well, you know, if you feed a newborn baby cow's milk, they don't do too well either.
Well, you don't. You're the first person I've known that's been willing to say that on the radio.
Oh, well, that's probably because I have absolutely no sponsorship, so I have nothing to lose.
All right. Well, anyway, I have a friend who's just turned 90 a month ago. Great guy, retired boat builder. And his two daughters are health nuts, and they're feeding him lots of raw milk. And they think it's a source of calcium for him. Now, I have nothing against milk myself. I eat yogurt and milk products, but I take lots of calcium supplements, and I drink rice milk, and I think I'm getting enough. I'm 73 myself.
Okay, what's the question?
The question is, the man, my friend, has a deteriorating hip joint, and he's eating a lot of milk products, flan and all that stuff, and I'm thinking that that's making things worse rather than better unless he gets an alternative supply of calcium somehow.
Well, if his hip joint is deteriorating, the chances are that there's some arthritis or some inflammation going on.
Right.
And I don't think that milk is going to be key one way or another, for that matter, calcium.
Good.
What I always recommend, however, for people with arthritis is that they go on an anti-inflammatory diet. And that diet is a diet that's actually relatively high in vegetables and legumes and whole grains.
Now you're talking to me. I'm trying to do that.
Right. And also fish. Yes. So if you, there's tons of Mediterranean diets, and that is the gist of it, though. It's fish, grains, lots of vegetables, healthy oils like olive oil, relatively small amounts of dairy, and relatively small amounts of dairy, but still some dairy, and relatively small amounts of meat.
Right.
Okay.
I know he's taking care of that. It's just that he's getting a lot of protein from his milk.
Yeah, well, he may be getting too much casein, and that's not the easiest protein to assimilate. But I don't think that's the key point. He needs to be on high-dose fish oil and glucosamine to help protect that hip joint.
Glucosamine, good.
Yeah, glucosamine. Yeah. And high-dose fish oil, and I mean like 4,000, 5,000 milligrams of fish oil a day at a minimum.
Would you say that again? How many?
5,000 milligrams.
Of fish oil. Okay.
Yeah, omega-3 fatty acids, and that'll help a lot with the inflammation, which is what's really causing the degeneration of his hip. And then weight-bearing exercise, check vitamin D levels. You need just to have a vitamin D level of at least 40.
How does he check that?
Blood test.
Okay.
He asks for a 25 hydroxy or a 25 hyphen OH vitamin D level. That's the one you want to look at.
25 hydroxy. Okay. And he should have at least 40. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So we had an off-air question. Dr. Gott in the Herald newspaper has a column that claimed that flax seed is good for omega-3 fatty acid, but there's research that shows it increases blood sugar levels, so it's bad for diabetics. Do I agree with that? Well, let's start out with flaxseed. Flaxseed oil has a precursor to EPA and DHA, but you have to eat an awful lot of flaxseed. Remember I was saying that you needed 5,000 milligrams of omega-3 fatty acids? Well, you would have to consume about 50,000 milligrams of flaxseed. That's 50 grams, which is doable. That's 2 ounces of flaxseed oil, but that's a lot of flaxseed oil. So I'm not sure that people are getting that kind of a dose. That's because only about 10% of the flaxseed oil ever makes it through your physiology into the end point products, which you're after, which are the EPA and the DHA. I do think it's good. I do think also that if you're running that much flaxseed oil through your system, you're probably really lowering the arachidonic acid pathways, and those are the more pro-inflammatory prostaglandins. So I think you're doing yourself some good. As far as the blood sugar levels going up, that's a new one on me, and I'll have to check into the flaxseed oil increases blood sugar levels. That's a little counterintuitive, and I'd want to look at the actual study and see how they figured that out, because certainly in science, the devil's in the details, and how you set up a study makes a huge difference. Recently, on that topic, a lot of news about the fact that, oh yes, vitamins actually don't prevent heart disease, and they're not good for you at all. And this is based on studies. Let's see, one of them was 7 years in 50,000 women looking at whether vitamin D prevented advanced breast cancer. Okay, well, if they did a 20-year study, it might be interesting. A 7-year study looking at the prevention of advanced breast cancer is beside the point. Breast cancer has a latency of longer than 7 years, probably where vitamin D is working, if it works at all. And I'd say that's still an open question, is at the front end of the disease. Once the horse done left the barn, it's not going to matter how tightly you lock the door. So let's go to our next caller, and that is Valerie in Aptos. Hello, Valerie. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Dr. Dawn. I really enjoy your show.
Thanks.
I called you back in March with chronic herpes, and you suggested the acyclovir.
Yeah.
And I just want to let you know I've been taking it for 9 months. The only breakout I had is when I couldn't get to the pharmacy for about 4 days, didn't have any medication, and I got a breakout. So it's been working. One of my fears has been, you know, that there would be some kind of side effects, and there hasn't been anything yet. And you talking to that caller today really helped kind of ease my mind a little bit.
Yeah, good, because I think you're on the right track. And after about the 2-year mark, start dropping your dose. See if you can get down to a very minimum, like a very, very minimum dose. And then if you're doing well with that and you don't have any breakthrough outbreaks, then just treat the prodromes. Go off of it entirely. And then the minute you think you're getting a little tingle, and then you start treating.
I tell you what, that the benefit is so incredible because that's very painful.
Yeah, quality painful of life, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I don't suffer from that, thank God. I can imagine how just a bladder infection I find so annoying and distracting. I can imagine that's like the mother of all bladder infections.
Well, yeah.
Just horrible. Don't want to go there.
Yes, I just really enjoy your show, and that was it. Have a happy new year.
Happy new year to you. Bye-bye. And let's go to Therese in Live Oak. Hello, Therese, and welcome to the show.
Hello. Hey, I have a question about nutritional supplements for children. I've been making a kind of a cocktail for my 9-year-old boys that includes a few different combinations of things. And I mix it up, and then I put it in a glass jar, like with a mason jar lid, and I have some chemical reaction that kind of gets this gooey black stuff on the top. And then I'm not sure whether I should give it to them again.
Okay, so are you mixing this up and then mixing up a batch and then giving it to them over several days' time?
Yeah.
Okay. It sounds like you're getting a precipitate, which means that some of the components in the mixture are reacting with each other and forming a salt or a compound that's quite possibly not going to dissolve when it's taken.
Oh.
So there's a whole science to mixing nutrients.
I'm kind of learning that.
Yeah, I mean, I've been to a couple of manufacturing facilities, and there's a lot of work to be done in the details, not only just putting the stuff together so they don't react with each other, but also making sure that they get into the body in a form that can actually be broken down.
Well, these are things that are actually already created, like it's the Kinderlove Children's Multivitamin by Floradix.
Right, but once you mix them with something else, you've opened the door to new and fun interactions.
Yeah.
And sometimes things are kept separate because they can't be given together. A good example of that is I have lots of patients who take a multivitamin, and it has calcium in it, but if you look at the actual amount, it's 150 milligrams of calcium, which is like a tenth of what you need.
Right.
But you can't fit 150 milligrams of calcium into a vitamin pill. It's just too bulky.
Yeah.
So you need a second pill just for considerations of bulk, aside from all of the various complex chemical interactions that can occur with things binding to each other. So I think you're getting a precipitate. You'd probably need to give these things separately.
Separately, okay. And then can I just tell you what they are? Do you know, or would it just...
You know, you can, but without knowing the actual list of ingredients, which I'm not going to let you read on the air, because I'll lose my entire audience.
Oh, darn.
But you can send me an email.
Okay.
And just go to askdrdawn.com, and you can, you know, type the whole thing out or scan it or send it as an attachment or whatever you like, and I'll do my best to answer your question.
All right, super. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So we had a caller who fell off the air. I have a cold, and over-the-counter remedies help. Symptoms return if I stop taking them, but do they prolong the cold? Okay, Barbara, that's actually a question I can answer fully. No, they don't. The cold is going to run its course. The so-called cold, typically that's going to be a viral infection, is going to multiply in your body until your immune system, initially your natural killer cells, and later on your actual directed immunity with the T cells directed against the virus, are going to eventually learn to kill the cells infected with the virus, eliminate those, and your symptoms will dissipate. That's how it works. You don't affect the course of the virus particularly by treating the symptoms. There's absolutely no virtue in suffering from the runny nose or the sore throat, as long as the cold medications don't make you feel sick. I found myself that the cure is worse than the disease, and I ended up feeling kind of drowsy and hyper at the same time from most cold medication formulas, so I just don't use them. I'm very fond of a Chinese herbal mixture called Yin Chao, which is Y-I-N-Q-I-A-O, and I first learned about that about 10 years ago when I was studying acupuncture, and it's become one of my medicine cabinet standbys because it just really swats the symptoms. And that's all I really expect out of a cold medication. Swap my symptoms for a few hours, and when they wear off, my symptoms come back. That's how it is. Let's go to Edward in Watsonville.
Wonderful. Good morning, Dr. Dawn.
Good morning.
Fabulous show.
Oh, thanks.
I was crawling around in my attic about a week ago, and it was a very tight space, and when I came down about a day or two later, my ribs just ached like mad. It's like I've torn some intercostal muscles or something.
Mm-hmm.
And getting comfortable in bed is almost impossible. I can't put any weight on it. I can't do anything with it.
What were you doing up there in the attic? Were you pushing or pulling something?
I was pulling and pushing and moving my body around.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you definitely used muscles that you don't normally use in an unusual configuration. And I'm inclined to agree with your intercostal muscle concept there. It's between two or several ribs on one side of your body. Is that correct?
It's down the body, down on the lower part, towards the side on the left side.
All right. I want you to do something for me. Sit sideways in a chair with the back of the chair so that your left elbow, is up on the back of the chair, and try to lift your body up by bringing your elbow down, you know, as if you were trying to fly away and the chair back is giving us the resistance. Can you do that for me?
Chair.
So your elbow's under a chair back, you're sitting sideways in the chair, and you're going to push your elbow down so that you're trying to lift your butt off the chair just using your left elbow, like a wing kind of downbeat on a wing. And I'm going to keep talking while you do that. I'm wondering about the latissimus dorsi muscle, which is, if you were going to be flying, it would be the muscle that brought your wings down. And when you're pulling something and you're in a awkward position, that muscle, too, goes to the area where you're having your pain. That muscle, too, can be involved.
Okay, I'm sitting in the chair mm-hmm. with the chair back.
All right, so sit sideways in the chair so that your left arm is sticking straight out from your side and your elbow is over the back of the chair.
Okay.
And now you're going to try to force your arm against the side of your body.
Then the pain is like right on the...
Does it aggravate it when you do that?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Go look up latissimus dorsi. Go look at an anatomy book or go online and look at where that muscle attaches on the back of the rib cage and see if that seems plausible to you. Now, in terms of what do you do about it, massage liniments, actually. If you're not too fat, someone may be able to rub that area with liniment or tiger balm or something like that and get some relief. Hot, moist soaks, but you want to be careful with a heating pad. If you do use a heating pad, don't lie on top of it.
Uh-huh.
I've seen some really nasty burns that way. You put yourself under the heating pad, not the heating pad under you. And if you have one that'll use a moist towel between the heating pad and you, that's excellent, deep penetrating heat. And, you know, realistically, it'll take about a week to resolve. If it doesn't start to improve after 4 to 5 days, then you probably need to seek medical attention.
Okay. I just saw one of the guys at work. He said, oh, I had that. It took about 6 months before I completely went away.
Aren't coworkers fun? Yes.
Right.
I don't know. You know, obviously, I'm diagnosing you over the radio,
right,
but I don't think so.
That's good news.
Yes, I thought it would be.
Okay, I will do that. I thank you so much.
And thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. We'll talk about Arlene in Houston. I watched my 14-year-old grandson experience an attack yesterday. I found terrifying, although his parents largely ignored it and hastened to assure me they'd had him checked out. We were celebrating my granddaughter's 10th birthday with a very, very sweet birthday cake. My grandson, who's 14, had a large piece and then began to shake all over. This lasted at least 15 minutes. He described it as a very pleasurable experience and said that after one of these episodes, which he'd obviously had before, he would go into a deep sleep, which he referred to as a crash. Please tell me if you think this is dangerous. I can't help but think it must be. He is ADD and takes medication for it, Concerta, I think. I'm not sure if he's ever in his entire life had a long enough night's sleep, but that's another matter, probably unrelated to this episode. Well, Arlene, I think what you saw there was most likely a low blood sugar reaction, and this happens when a person eats a large sugar load, and then their pancreas puts out a lot of insulin, and they have a rapid decline in blood sugar, usually an overshoot. At about the time that you overshoot and the blood sugar is rapidly dropping down, the adrenal glands sense this change and they kick out adrenaline. Adrenaline causes the body to shake. It causes the heart to beat. It would certainly be amplified in someone who was taking Concerta because they're already stimulating some of their adrenaline receptors with that drug. And that shaking would typically last up to about 15 minutes for one of these little adrenaline storms. And then the counter-regulatory hormones, you know, the adrenaline kicks in, and then first the insulin kicks in, blood sugar drops, the adrenaline kicks in, blood sugar goes up, and then there's too much adrenaline, and another counter-regulatory hormone kicks in, and that's probably endorphin in this case, and that's that lovely lull and the nice deep sleep that he's getting. You know, revving the engine, popping the clutch, not necessarily the healthiest things in the world. What I'd be most concerned about is that if you keep doing rapid release of insulin, if this boy keeps eating lots of sweets and having this reaction, I'm concerned that over time, maybe when he gets into his 30s or 40s, he may be at risk for diabetes prematurely because he's kind of burned out his insulin receptors. So I would encourage his parents, and yes, I know it's Texas and he has a 10-year-old sister, but I would encourage his parents to make sure that this boy gets some protein if he eats any sweets at all. That'll help blunt the response. And it's a lot harder to take things away than it is to add things. And just from a strategic standpoint, you're the grandmother and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Making sure that they give him some protein, like some walnuts, along with the sugar might go a long way to blunting these responses. Hope that helps. Let's go to Bill in Santa Cruz. Hello, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Dr. Don.
Hello.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My question is about my daughter, who is, she has a diagnosis of Hashimoto's thyroiditis.
Mm-hmm. How old is she?
She's She is 15.
15, okay.
And she was diagnosed, she was in the third grade, so I guess she was 9, 8.
That's very young. Is there a family history of thyroid disease or autoimmune disease?
No, there's not.
Okay, go ahead.
So my challenge is basically that she is on her artificial thyroid medication, and she takes that regularly, and that's all going well. But the challenge that is weight control, getting her to exercise. She's about 50 pounds overweight at this point.
And that's going to be a big problem for her if we don't nip that in the bud at 15. Do you have custody? Are you a live-in dad?
Yes.
Okay. So you have some sway, some influence there that you wouldn't have if you were a non-custodial parent.
Right.
Okay, so the key to weight control in a teenager is, number one, we need to make sure that she has adequate levels. Her TSH should be right there in the middle, you know, 2.2, 2.3, not 4.5. So you want to be sure that those numbers are kept really between 1 and 2.5, ideally. So dose adjustment might be in order. Controlling the amount of simple sugars and carbohydrates, essentially no soda, no juice, try to really influence the household in the direction of what beverages are available. Get the sugared beverage just out of the house. Whatever it takes to do that, do it. She needs to learn how to drink water or tea or something that's not sweetened. And the sooner she learns that, the better off she'll be in her life. The other thing that I mentioned, simple carbohydrates, things like pasta and bread and starches, snack foods that are heavy in those are things that really, it's hard to control your weight if you're eating a lot of those in your diet. So it may mean that everyone else in the household has to make some concessions as well. But availability, you know, having healthy foods around, is she's still at the age where you can influence her preferences. You need to all basically demonstrate good eating behavior so that she picks up on it. And then the last one is exercise. And what you can do there is you can find something that you and your daughter can do together, because you are still... you're still a carrot at 15. You know, you haven't become the, hopefully at least, you haven't become the, you know, the Antichrist and won't for another couple of years. So if you can find some sort of physical activity, bicycling or hiking or swimming or something that the two of you can actually get into doing together, even ping pong, you know, but you're basically bribing her with some quality time, but trying to find something you can do, even if she's totally like a video game person. There's actually a new sort of video game. We'll ask the geeks to talk about it briefly. So stay tuned to the next show. It's kind of like virtual reality exercise.
The Wii?
I think that's what it's called, yeah. So something like that, but you've got to get her moving, is really what I'm saying.
And, yeah.
And it means some time investment on your part. There's no magic pill here. About shaping behaviors, that those behaviors are going to influence her for the rest of her life. And she's already got a strike against her because she's, you know, she's heavy at 15, and so it really needs to be turned around and pretty soon, in the next couple of years, or it's going to be a lifelong issue for her. And it's not just her thyroid. That can be worked around. And make sure she has a vitamin D level that's at least 35 or 40, because autoimmune disease in someone that age really disturbs me, and I'm wondering, you know, what's wrong with her immune regulation system that she's got an autoimmune disease.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Very good.
All right. Good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. And we had a request to repeat that name. That is Hashimoto's thyroiditis, and it is an autoimmune attack on the thyroid gland. Etiology is, well, we know it's autoimmune. We don't know what triggers it, although there's certain people who think it's triggered by iodine deficiency. There's others who think that too much iodine is dangerous in that situation. So I think there's a fair amount of controversy on the iodine issue with that respect to that. Time for another last email. This one from Tara in Georgia. Facial hair. I've had some facial hair on my chin and lips since age 16. I'm 39. It seemed to start while I was still pretty thin. I've always been a runner, but was running about 80 miles a week at that time in competitive cross country, and my periods had stopped. They found my estrogen levels were that of a postmenopausal woman. I took Premarin and Provera for a while, ye gods, but oh well, and gained some weight. The periods returned, but the hair growth never went away. She's done electrolysis, waxing, Vanica, and currently she's tweezing. She's still not underweight, runs 20 to 30 miles a week. any suggestions other than prescription drugs or laser hair removal? Well, Tara, I think that what's happening here is that you have a little bit of elevation in your DHEA, and you could have that tested, and also your serum testosterone, and see if those things are in balance. I think that you're stimulating the hair follicles, and the two things that can be used for this are spironolactone and metformin, both of which are prescription drugs. And I don't see that there's anything wrong with the tweezing, but now that you're 39, I do think it might not be such a bad idea to get a bone density. And again, I'm sounding like a broken record here, but get that vitamin D checked. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.